Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.
And it's time for Movies and Booze, the second last one before Christmas, because we will be doing one on Christmas Eve as well. Here in the studio today, though, are Fionnuala Jones, Chris Wasser and Dee McGuinness. Good afternoon to you all.
Hello.
Hi guys.
It looks like you brought in your usual frightening selection of beers, Dee.
It's Christmas time, yeah. So you have to have some nice ones, yeah. Yeah, we're drinking for Jesus. We're drinking Trappist beers. And we have a first. It's a Trappist collaboration. So it's a beer called Three Rules, and it is a collaboration between La Trappe Zundert and Tint Meadow in the UK. So La Trappe and Zundert are both in the south of Holland, and Tint Meadow is in about the centre of the UK. And they've come together and brewed a Trappist beer. All three breweries are Trappist breweries.
Mm.
But they've come together and designed the brewery between the three of them.
Okay, how did they do a collab? Breweries? Because I assume it has to be brewed in one of those places.
Yeah, it's brewed in La Trappe, and then they come together and agree on, different things in terms of, basically get the brewers together and they put their thinking caps on as to how to design and do the beer, and then look for input from all three.
Okay.
And the other beer, so that's kind of the new beer, because Tint Meadow and Zundert are the two newest Trappist breweries. There's been seven Trappist breweries for ages. We lost one because they lost their last monk. And if you don't have a monk in the monastery, then it can't be a Trappist brewery anymore. So
that makes sense. Absolutely.
So it's officially,
when you say they lost them, like they.
Well, I went to La Trappe, and when
Jimmy went for a walk and disappeared, and there was something floating in that vat over there.
I went to La Trappe, and at that stage, I think he was one of the youngest Trappist monks in the world, and he was about kind of late 30s, early 40s, about 15 years ago. But the average age was, into the kind of 70s for a lot of the monks. So,
well, does that mean that Trappist beers might die out if they're not getting monks?
That was the concern, because with the loss of Achill, went from 7 to 6, and then we had kind of a little bit of an explosion of Trappist breweries. Chimay did some work with a brewery called Montechat and brewed some beers to allow them to see if they felt it would be viable for them to set up their own brewery. They didn't do it, but there is a new one in the UK, a new one in the Netherlands, a new one in Austria. There was a new one in the US, but it went for a period of time, and then they haven't continued it. It was called Spencer, so I got to taste the beer before it disappeared. It's no longer there anymore. But we now have 12 Trappist breweries as opposed to 7. So even though we've lost one, we've gained a few more.
Okay, and second beer today.
Second beer is Chimay Oak Aged, and what they do is each year they do a different blend. So I thought if I was going to do kind of the newest of the Trappist beers, I would bring in a 5-year-old bottle of Armagnac Oak Aged Chimay. So it was brewed in 2020 and has been aged for 5 years. And it was brewed, aged in a trio of barrels, French oak, American oak, and in Armagnac barrels. So Armagnac is similar to cognac, distilled in a slightly different way. And you get bit of the character of the Armagnac. Yeah.
Okay, ooh, very fancy altogether. Now, I did hear Fionnuala Jones squealing with delight that you were going to do the Wallace and Gromit movie.
We are. We're going to take a look at Wallace and Gromit: Vengeance Most Fell. And when I get into the plot of the film, you'll realise how fabulous a title that is. But it's a sequel to The Wrong Trousers. So a very long time in the making. And also the first Wallace and Gromit outing in 16 years. Because there hasn't been either a half-hour Wallace and Gromit special or a feature-length Wallace and Gromit film in 16 years. So I didn't realise the gap was that big. And we're also going to look at another animation, two sequels today. Well, one and a half sequels. Mufasa the Lion King is technically a prequel inside of a sequel. I'll explain shortly. But this is part of, the way the lads at Disney are currently in the process of remaking everything. And they have their live-action roster. Well, obviously, it's notoriously difficult to teach lions how to sing. So what they've done for the Lion King films is go for the photorealistic, the hyper photorealistic CG approach. So that is, make your films as authentic looking as possible. Make these things look like they're David Attenborough documentaries and then put Broadway musical numbers in them. So
yeah, but the hyper realistic look, there's something disturbing about them.
Yeah. It's an awkward marriage. It really is. And like, my hat's off to them. Like, when you're watching these films, you're like, this is incredible looking. If someone were to turn the volume down in the cinema, you would think you're watching a documentary, but with the volume at full blast and with the songs playing, it's just very unsettling. But we'll get into that later. Second Lion King film, obviously the first Lion King film that was obviously a remake of the animation.
Yeah.
There's an awkward sentence. Made $1.7 billion. So
yeah.
This thing was unavoidable. This thing is always going to happen.
Absolutely. And they're totting up the worst rated films of 2024, and apparently it was all Nepo baby directors.
Yeah, which I just thought there was an interesting bit of journalism from Variety this week. The Nepo baby directors did not have a good 2024. And what I mean by that is, like, usually the children of other famous directors or celebrities, stuff like that. I think Red One was reviewed on this show previously. I can't remember who reviewed
it. Yeah, not great, yeah.
That came from Jake Kasdan, who has had some success previously, I think, with the Jumanjis. Red One was a huge flop. I think it had a budget of $175 million, or no, sorry, the budget of $250 million, and only made $175 million and was like critically destroyed. I actually didn't realise who Jake Kasdan was. He is the son of Lawrence Kasdan, who's like a 4-time Oscar nominee.
Yeah.
And then you also have M. Night Shyamalan's daughter, came out with The Watchers, which completely passed me by, supernatural horror film. And again, the piece kind of makes the argument that, you know, like, first time directors, a lot of these Nepo babies are first time directors, but like, if you're a first time director, you'd never be able to secure the budgets that they're getting. They're only getting them, or there's probably one of the large reasons they're getting them is because of their familial connections. Like, Shannon Night Shyamalan got $30 million budget for The Watchers, but I think it pulled in, I think it was 33 million worldwide, so not great.
Okay.
And again, critics did not like it. You had the same kind of scenario for Zelda Williams, although I will say with this one, she did Lisa Frankenstein, which again I think was reviewed on the show a couple of months ago, like a rom-com horror kind of hybrid, like making a boyfriend out of a zombie, whatever. I feel like that will kind of, again, like, didn't make a lot of money, but I feel like that's going to get a cult kind of following away.
She's Robin Williams' daughter.
In terms of who actually was successful, kind of the only one that avoided kind of total flopdom was actually Zoe Kravitz with Blink Twice.
Okay.
That cost 20 million. She made 40 million. I think the reviews were kind of mixed, but maybe more slightly leaning positive. So what do we take from this, guys? I don't know. Maybe try new people who don't have famous connections.
But then again, if they'd done a list of every first-time director in the year and how much money they'd made or hadn't made, maybe it would have been similar.
Maybe
this is just Variety being a bit bitchy.
Maybe a little bit bitchy, but I don't know. Tis the season to be a little bit bitchy.
To be bitchy, yeah, that's what Christmas is all about. They're making a document. Well, I suppose it's kind of...
Oh, but this was inevitable.
Yeah,
no.
It was inevitable. Luigi Mangione, they're making a documentary about.
So many documentaries in the works, but I just wanted to focus on two that I think are coming from, like, kind of reputable people in terms of, like, their work previously in the world of documentary. Obviously, Luigi Mangione charged in the killing of the United Health CEO. Brian Thompson, Alex Gibney is working on one, an Oscar winner. He's worked on ones about Elon Musk before. And then we also have Stephen Robert Morse is working on one. If you don't know that name, he did the Amanda Knox documentary for Netflix. But then there's a couple of other TV ones that I think the films will be kind of more significant, and some of the TV ones seem a bit like rush trying to beat the story, and like,
nothing's
obviously kind of happened since, but I know it's become such a spectacle and such a talking point. Then you have people kind of fan casting is a horrific word to use in this instance, but like, I don't know what else to say, in the sense that like, they're kind of dream casting for who plays Luigi Mangione again in the inevitable biopic film about this situation. Dave Franco's name is being thrown around a lot because they kind of look alike.
Give that a year, that
film will exist in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, Ryan Murphy will make it.
Yes, he will.
He will
do that.
I hate it already.
You see, even making it this quickly, we have no historical perspective on this. We don't know if, like, this time next year he's just vaguely remembered as a nutcase who shot somebody, rather than it had some greater significance than that. You know, if it led to wide-scale reform of the health system in the US, then maybe. And, you know, no better man than Donald Trump to help more people.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. God, it really is bandwagon stuff, really, isn't it?
Truly.
David wants to know, Dean, will the upcoming change in label legislation, will these beers be available ongoing?
Yeah, this is something that annoys me quite significantly. They are bringing in legislation in May 2026. which technically, scientifically, is wrong. And I'll challenge anybody to say it. They're saying beer causes cancer and beer causes liver disease. Excess drinking of beer increases your risk of cancer and liver disease, but moderate drinking of beer improves your life expectancy. There is quite...
Oh, wow. Thanks, Dean. I think we might, you know, ask a scientist at the very least about that one.
No, genuinely, they've done longitudinal studies and taking literally hundreds of studies. There's a J-shaped curve on alcohol consumption. That basically you start off with a certain level of mortality, and then as you drink moderately, your mortality improves. It does things like it thins your blood slightly, so reduce your risk of stroke and things like that. Now, moderate drinking is, you know, a drink a day every couple of days, you know, like the way that we drink in Ireland, we do tend to go out on a Friday and drink significantly to excess.
Yeah.
And if that was spread out, it would make a hell of a lot more sense to have a drink every now and then rather than to drink in binge drinking fashion, which is bad for your health. But yeah, I think that there are politicians who feel that Ireland got profiled because of the smoking ban and being the first country in the world to do it. So they've come up with this idea that they're going to require every product with alcohol in it to have a label on it stating this, and we're the only country in Europe that is doing it. And people should consume alcohol healthily. The reason why I'm in the area of alcohol that I'm in is because the philosophy is to drink less and drink better. You drink better quality alcohol and you drink it in smaller quantities. If you were to put similar labels on all of the products that increase your risk of cancer, you would be literally putting labels on virtually everything. There's a book called Panic Nation that lists out the things that increase your risk of cancer. And it starts naming them one word at a time. And the list goes on for six pages. And it says these are the things that have been covered in the media that increase your risk of cancer.
Is that going to affect, though, I suppose, to answer David's question, does that mean that we'll be certain... I suppose alcohol manufacturers, not just beer manufacturers, who aren't going to go, I'm not going to print an additional label for Ireland.
And likewise, you know, putting it on as a kind of a catch-all, you know, and then having that all across Europe where you don't necessarily want it. Basically, what it means is it's going to increase the cost of product because things will have to be labelled by hand. And it's an incredibly expensive thing to do.
Yeah, so that might affect that. Okay,
yeah.
All right. Okay, well, what was it, Sleeper? The Woody Allen film where there's a scene where everyone's smoking cigarettes and they're going, who thought this was bad for you back in the day? Right, so let's increase our mortality by sipping on this 15% beer.
So the first one, 3 rules, only half that, 7.5%. Okay. This is 7.4. So this is called 3 rules. The name 3 rules comes from, aside from it being 3 Trappist breweries that have collaborated to brew the beer, there are 3 rules required to make a beer an authentic Trappist product. The beer has to be brewed on the site of the monastery. It can't be brewed in a separate brewery. It has to be brewed under the supervision of Trappist monks, and all of the profits from it need to go to the monastery and the charitable work that the monks do. So
okay.
with Abbey beers, typically what happens is there's a kind of a royalty, usually about 5-10% of the sales price goes to the Abbey, but with a Trappist brewery. And they're very, very protective of that. There is an association called the International Trappist Association, and they do very, very strongly adhere to it. Mentioned Achill losing its Trappist appellation because it is no longer a Trappist monastery. It doesn't have any Trappist monks there. That is now, you know, it can only be an Abbey beer unless the concept was moved to another thing. But if it was moved,
okay.
It was named after the thing. With this, it is a Trappist double. So usually Trappist doubles around 6-8% ABV. This one is 7.4% ABV. And the types of flavours that you expect to get out of it, usually dark fruit flavours. But with this one, there's quite a bit of chocolate in it. So plain chocolate, kind of a blend of dark fruit flavours. There's a gingerbread, treacle bread type of character to it, and boozy fruit, the type of, if you've got somebody who makes a Christmas pudding by doing a mix of fruit and soaking it in alcohol and leaving that there for a number of weeks so that the fruit really absorbs all of the alcohol, it's got that kind of boozy fruit type of character to it.
Yeah.
Done absolutely wonderful job in it. Both of these beers, both the beers that we're tasting together, superb with Christmas pudding, Christmas cake. You've got a crossover of the flavours with the kind of dark fruit flavours between both Christmas cake and Christmas puddings.
There's a bit of Christmas pudding in there already, really. You can, I don't know if you even need the Christmas pudding. And it's nice, because the La Trappe glasses are lovely, but there's a nice head in it, because if you looked at it, you might think it was Guinness out of a bottle
it's quite dark. Yeah, the other Trappist, La Trappe's own double is kind of quite red brown, you know, it's a distinctively lighter colour, and Chimay the same has a kind of a red brown tint to it. This has a bit more roast to it, and that chocolate flavour coming through. It's using darker malts, but yeah, and the rule with Belgian beers generally, you measure head in terms of fingers, so the thickness of your finger, so with a Belgian beer you're usually looking at kind of two or three fingers of head, which is sorry.
Just move off that sentence quickly, Dean.
So if you put kind of two fingers together or three fingers together, that's the.
I think there was a woman on the internet got really famous for talking about that. Right, you are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Chris, what movie would you like to do first?
Mufasa.
We'll do Mufasa after this.
Back to the trees. We're trapped. We have to swim.
No, we have to fight.
If we fight, we die.
But if we swim, we drown.
Okay, I didn't want to do this, but I command you to swim.
You what?
You pledge your loyalty. I command you to swim.
Tucker, this is not the time for jokes.
Which one of you killed my son?
I did. This lion with me is nothing but a stray. Let him go.
Kiddos.
The other is no stray.
He holds the blood of the pride.
The last blood of the king. Blood for blood.
Right, that's Mufasa, the Lion King. Well, obviously. Right, so this is a prequel then, Chris.
It is. It's a prequel inside a sequel. So what I mean by that is it kind of picks up where Jon Favreau's photorealistic remake of The Lion King left off, in that, you know, Simba and Nala, that's Donald Glover in the vocal department, and also Beyonce voicing Nala. She's got about three or four lines in this, and that's about it.
Okay.
They are about to have another cub, and the cub that they already have, Kiara, voiced by Blue Ivy Carter, that's Beyonce's daughter. It's a big, you know, it's very much a family affair. she is all anxious about kind of her place in the world, and thinks that, you know, she should be, you know, this, she should be kind of like her dad by now, you know, not afraid of anything. There's a storm coming in, she's terrified. So Simba leaves Kiara with Timon and Pumbaa, voiced by Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen, and they are, you know, it's the Flatulent Warthog and the Yappy Meerkat, and they decide alongside Rafiki, you know, the wise old mandrill, to calm Kiara's anxieties by telling her a story about her grandfather. So that's how you're able to sync it.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's a very clumsy framing device, but it just means that Disney is able to keep Timon and Pumbaa in there. They're able to keep the Hakuna Matata boys in there. They're able to sell toys if they want to. But it's all about Mufasa. Now, Mufasa can't be voiced this time around by James Earl Jones, who sadly passed away. So this film is dedicated to him, and they have found Aaron Pierre is doing a decent enough job here, but you can't replace James Earl Jones.
But
at all.
If this is a young Mufasa, he wouldn't have the James Earl Jones thing yet.
Yeah,
maybe.
I mean,
one could argue, perhaps.
Well, they've got a young actor to play the kind of the baby Mufasa, and then they've got Aaron Pierre to play kind of sort of grown up Mufasa. I don't know if you would have needed another one. I'd say if James Earl Jones survived, they would have asked him to do this.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, he is voicing Mufasa, and Mufasa it's sort of a copy and paste job. It's Mufasa had the same sort of upbringing as Simba, in that he was separated from his parents in some sort of flood, and he thinks that he's an orphan, stumbles upon another family, meets the small lion that would become his half brother. He goes by the name Taka here, but I probably don't need to say what name he goes by in The Lion King.
Yeah.
And they are separated from the pack after Mads Mikkelsen. If Mads Mikkelsen is in this, you know he's going to be the villain. That's it. It's in his contract that he has to only play the villain. He's a white lion that wants to get rid of Taka's entire family. So these two young cubs, they run away. They encounter Mufasa's future bride. Obviously, the lion that will become Scar is in love with her, and a fallout is inevitable. So this is all happening. For some reason, this is the story. This terrifying story of, you know, families dying and cubs being separated from the families is the story that settles Kiara's nerves during the storm.
It would. You can see why.
Yeah. So very clumsy, very clunky. There's an awful lot going on in there. This film would work if it was a cartoon. It really would work if it was a cartoon, because these films are inherently silly and they're supposed to be, you know, hand drawn, maybe CG animations. They're supposed to be big stage musicals. In the original, we had that gorgeous songbook by Elton John and Tim Rice. We've seen the way they work. They don't work like this. And it's such a shame, too, because that hyper-realistic, you know, photorealistic computer-generated job, it is beautiful. It really is. I'd watch it all day. And there's things that they're doing in this film that I didn't realize that they could do. So full marks to the animation department. But we're talking about expressionless creatures here. And when they start singing Lin-Manuel Miranda's songs, it's horrifying. It really is. Like, it's so strange, and it never really settles it. And you know what? Actually, a few weeks ago, I was giving out about the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda wasn't involved in the Moana sequel. And for me, that actually hurt the Moana sequel, because his songs were the best thing about that first film. But he's in terrible form in this film. I found the songs here just uncharacteristically bland. Like, no real soul to them. There's no real bangers. You should, like, if you want to make a sequel to The Lion King, everyone involved who wants to be involved in that should sit down, watch The Lion King, and if they can't come out and say that they can do better than what Elton John, than what, you know, Hans Zimmer did, leave it alone. And you can't. And so it feels as though he's having a real off day here. And also, you heard some of the voice performers in that clip. If listeners didn't know that was The Lion King, they'd be wondering, is that some sort of thriller where some fella is drowning? Mm. And everyone's kind of like doing their own voices. Like Calvin Harrison Jr., Beyonce again has a few lines in it, Donald Glover, Aaron Pierre. They're all just basically acting in their own voices. This is The Lion King! You're supposed to go above and beyond. You're supposed to. I mean, I give out about the fact that, like, Timon and Pumbaa, Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen, they're doing a bit too much, but they're voice acting. That's what they're supposed to be. Yes, everyone else is just going in, speaking the way that they speak, and then leaving. So there's no real heart in it. There's no real soul. I just found it just such an awkward film. And actually, the biggest mistake that it makes, it takes itself very, very seriously.
Oh, dear.
You can't do that in a film about talking lions and monkeys. You can't do that at all.
Oh, God.
So I did not, I found it so pointless, so po-faced. And also, I should mention, I wasn't going to mention this, Barry Jenkins directed it. Mm. How Barry Jenkins went from Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk to The Lion King doesn't make any sense to me. Obviously, Moonlight was the film. Remember when La La Land didn't win Best Picture, but everyone thought it did? Yeah. No, the prize that year went to Moonlight, which is this gorgeous coming-of-age LGBTQ+ film about a young black man. It kind of catches him at three stages in his life, when he's a kid, a young adult, and then later on catching up with all of the friends that he has as a kid. Beautiful, beautiful film. I don't know how Barry Jenkins went from that to The Lion King.
We all got to pay the rent, I guess.
That's true. That's true. But I was thinking that there might be some sort of Jenkins stamp here. There isn't. I wish him well, and I understand if he was doing it for, you know, for the check, but get back to making real films, Barry.
Because I don't know, but I would guess here, if you enter the Disney empire, it's almost like you're directing mechanically. They're not asking you to come in and, you know, bring a brand new idea. They're asking you to stick within the franchise and make sure we sell toys and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, that's it. You're a glorified floor manager. The same every time you see that a Marvel film is going to be directed by that indie director you loved one film by, they're coming in and they're slowly realizing, because they do interviews 5 or 6 years later, I was kind of restricted and I wasn't allowed to do that. Of course you weren't. You're going into a warehouse where there's already a manager there, and you're just being, like, if they don't like what you're doing, they'll change it. So there's no real, I don't know why all of these directors are attracted to that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, got to pay the rent and all that. It almost seems like a semi-regular thing we do, where we mention films that Billy Bob Thornton wasn't in. Is he a serial turner downer of roles?
Seems like it, yeah. And to be honest, I'd rather talk about that than any of the 700 reboots that are announced every week that I'm on this. I just thought it was interesting that he was almost Green Goblin in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, because that's like kind of an iconic Willem Dafoe role now, obviously one that he took back up for the more recent iterations with Tom Holland and stuff. But I can also see Billy Bob in that role.
Yeah.
But he said he didn't want to do because he just essentially wasn't bothered with the makeup. He said he didn't feel like getting up at 4 a.m. for 5 or 6 hours of makeup. But he also turned down Mission Impossible 3 because he I don't know how serious he's being when he said this, but he just said he didn't want to be seen as the guy trying to kill Tom Cruise. It seemed like he was kind of trying to infer that it would hinder his future career prospects because he would just be solidified as the villain coming up against Tom Cruise. And again, also then I'm not sure if he's trying to imply other things. It was Philip Seymour Hoffman ended up getting.
Oh yeah, his career really stalled after that.
Yeah,
he was rubbish.
Yeah, it's just interesting that he could have been obviously Billy Bob Thornton very successful, and he's in that new Paramount series that seems to be quite good. Landman, it's kind of Yellowstone-esque. I haven't watched it, I'm going to admit. Incredible in Fargo, love Fargo. Go watch that season of Fargo over Christmas if you're looking for things to binge. But he could have been real mainstream man, weird old guy that Willem Dafoe is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, they're there, I suppose.
Just love those sliding
doors.
There's
no point living with those regrets, I suppose.
I don't think he does regret it. I don't think he definitely wouldn't have been as enthusiastic about coming back as Green Goblin as much as Willem Dafoe was. Willem Dafoe was I want to come back, I want to do my own stunts, I love this. Billy Bob didn't even want to get up to do the initial makeup, so
yes.
I think they made the right choice.
If you didn't want to get up early in the morning, yeah, that tells you a lot, really. And we now have an official title for the second 4 hour long Wicked Mill movie.
Yeah, so it's not going to be called Wicked 2, it's going to be called Wicked for Good, which obviously references the song that's in the second half of the stage show and that will feature in this film. It's out November 21st, 2025. The title seems to have kind of divided fans. I'm not in enough of the lore to kind of understand why. And when I heard it initially, I was like, well, that's a good, it's better than Wicked 2. I think Wicked 2 is not a good title, you know what I mean? And at least this is all within the canon and stuff like that. I don't know. They were both filmed at the same time. So, the second film is just kind of essentially waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
Why didn't they bring it out earlier? Why didn't they want to bring it out earlier? That's a good question. I'm not really sure. Probably just a bit of breathing room, you know what I mean? I think, and you're still not waiting that. A year isn't that long.
I know,
of a
but
time.
Say, bring it out in the summer. Because at that stage of the game, everyone is going to, it's probably on the first bits on streaming and blah, blah, blah.
You're probably competing with a lot of other big films in the summer. No, franchises.
I know it's not a Christmas story, but it's associated with Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's fair enough. Yeah, I suppose we'd have that.
They might have to go back and change some of the prints as well, because the only place that you'll see Wicked Part 1 written is on screen in the actual film.
Yeah.
Not any of the promotional materials, because they didn't want audiences to know, because recent films that have had a part one in them have actually underperformed because audiences are well, I'm not going in for this because I'll have to go see another one. So are they going to change that now? That'll be interesting. When Wicked is added to streaming services, will the part one be removed? Will that just be known as Wicked and the other one known as Wicked for Good?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Or will they at some point edit the two of them together?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate that.
That would not be good.
Spend a weekend watching it.
That must be why Tom Cruise changed the most recent, because it was Dead Reckoning Part 1.
Yeah,
but now it's, what is it, The Final Reckoning?
The Final Reckoning, yeah. And then if you buy that film on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, at some point down the line, the first one won't say Part 1 anymore.
That's so costly to do that. It seems like such a waste of money. Nobody cares.
Yeah. There was another interesting piece as well, just on the topic of Wicked in Vanity Fair, that was talking about, because the stage show is based on a book called Wicked, which again I think people don't know. And then when Wicked, the book came out, it was a publishing sensation as much as the show has been and the film has been. And initially when it came out, there was a lot of people looking to get the rights to it, which I thought was interesting. You'd Whoopi Goldberg, I think Demi Moore's production company had originally optioned the rights. And when they were talking about, I think the original whatever production company they were, or it was Demi Moore obviously had an existing relationship with Universal at that time, and they were viewing her as a potential Elphaba, which I think is just again the sliding door of what this film could have been in terms of Glinda. I think Suzanne Todd, who was Moore's producing partner at the time, had said her wish list was Michelle Pfeiffer, Emma Thompson, Nicole Kidman. Just very interesting to see where we are now with what the film ended up being to what
so many
could
years
have been
later.
In the midst. So.
Yeah, that's that is so interesting. And just going back to the title, why are some fans again the title?
I don't know. That's why I'm listeners, if you're into Wicked and you're not pleased with the title, can you explain why? Because I didn't get it. I was this makes perfect sense. It references the song, the biggest song of the second half. I don't think that's a spoiler to say if you're familiar with the show.
Yeah.
I think it's good. Do you think it's good? No?
No.
No?
The film. Yeah, I've got a lot of God, it's long kind of reports.
Four. Oh, yeah. No, I loved it. No, I really
that
really
was on an ideas board, and someone was asked to have a name ready for Monday, and they didn't, so they just went with that. That just seems.
But what else do you call it other than Wicked Two? Like
Wicked Part Two is fine. Part J.
Yeah.
Take your inspiration from the airplane movies.
Yeah.
Or whichever one that was, Naked Gun movies. Is Mufasa just like The Godfather Part Two when Coppola used flashbacks to tell the story of the young Vito Corleone?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison there.
Yeah, there was no need for me to go off and around for 5 minutes. It's that. It's just that.
Right. Tell us about our second beer there, Dave.
So we are tasting Chimay Grand Reserve Oak Aged. So Chimay Grand Reserve or Chimay Blue was originally a Christmas beer. It was released as a seasonal beer.
Mm.
And as time went on, it was a seasonal beer that people anticipated more and more. So they started extending the season and it became a beer that was available all year round. And now the non-oak-aged version is the most popular of the Chimay beers. What they've started doing with this is they get a selection of different barrels and then age Chimay Blue in those barrels for about 6 months and then blend each year a selection of Chimay Blues from different barrels into a single blend. So this is the 2020 blend. It was the blend that was done in 2020. And it is a blend of two oaks and an Armagnac barrel. So Armagnac is a type of brandy. It's from the Armagnac region of France, and it's a very high quality brandy. Now, with this, at this stage now, we're at the end of 2024. So this beer is coming up on 5 years old in the bottle.
Mm.
On top of the almost a year to brew it. What you've got is there's a change in character that happens with beers. This beer will vintage for 10, 15 years without any difficulty whatsoever. Like it will age and as long as you don't kind of put it in the sunlight on the windowsill or something
but
like that.
But will it change in that time?
Yes, it will. Yeah, there's a very good book called Vintage Beer that has had a look at a selection of different beers that have been vintaged, and the guy who's written the book, he has profiled the flavour changes over time for specific beers and had a look at what the changes are in different beers and different beer styles. So in general terms, what you get, the dark malt flavours will tend to combine with higher alcohols and mellow out. So if you think of dark malt flavour as being like the kind of the charcoal on a burnt steak, something like that, when you've literally just burned a steak, it can be a little bit roasty, a little bit acidic, a little bit bitter. But if you imagine that flavour as being, you know, the kind of gentle roasting of a casserole and it kind of being a smoother, softer flavour. That's what happens over time as the higher alcohols and the dark malt flavours combine. Generally, hop flavours will reduce, but this isn't a beer that's about hops. It's all about the fermentation and the malt. And flavours like bitterness will reduce over time as well. But the big thing that has happened with this beer is that the flavours have blended beautifully. You've got dark fruit flavour. And if I was doing a tasting with a group of people that we do tastings with and they said dark fruit flavour, I'd say, what is the dark fruits? You know, which ones is it? They blend together so well that it's quite difficult to separate them out. But you've got dates, figs, plums, raisins all blending in. But it isn't like tasting, you know, a date, a fig, a plum side by side. They are all blended together. Obviously, at 10.5% ABV, you've got a bit of alcohol hit to it.
But it tastes... It is the
so
previous
smooth.
Beer tastes stronger than this beer.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The
smoothening over the 5 years really does just make it incredibly drinkable. And then you've got a certain amount of spiciness coming from the oak. And interestingly, a kind of a coconut, vanilla and white pepper spice, and that's coming from the oak barrels. Along with the brandy, it's kind of redundant to say that beer aged in brandy barrels has a brandy flavour to it.
Mm.
But what's nice about this is that with spirits that are distilled up to kind of 35, 40, 45, 50% ABV, you've got quite a burn of alcohol in it. With this, you've got a kind of a subtle suggestion of alcohol coming through. But you don't get the alcohol burn because it's, you know, a quarter of the alcohol content.
Yeah. Yep. It should be pointed out as well, both those beers come in kind of
750
like a what? Yeah, a 750 mil bottle. So it's that kind of servings idea. So there's going to be a series two of Day of the Jackal and also Dune Prophecy.
Yeah, which has a lot of good Irish talent in it, from what I've heard. Haven't watched it. Oh, not God. A big Dune
which
girl.
One? Oh, yeah.
In the series. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I watched I watched the first one, couldn't finish it.
Of Doom Prophecy.
Yeah, it was so tedious. And okay. It's so self-important. And it's so, this is, you know, portentous stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
A lot of what I've read from friends and peers seems to be that they were kind of surprised that they got renewed because they just haven't felt like the first season has found its way at all. But, I mean, if you're into it, there you go. Yeah, Day of the Jackal coming back for season 2. I don't want to say too much about this for anyone who is planning on watching or still watching or wants to catch up over Christmas and the New Year. It's based on the 1972 book and 1973 feature film starring Edward Fox as this cold-blooded assassin, the Jackal. He's being sought after. Again, I had read initial reviews of this that this wasn't great, but I keep hearing people
saying they enjoyed it.
About it.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm wrong and I shouldn't listen to what I've heard and go back and watch.
Yeah. Right. We'll move on to our second movie of the day. It is Wallace and Gromit: Vengeance Most Foul. Here's a clip.
Hi, I'm your nifty odd-jobbing robot. Call me Norbot.
This is my latest invention.
Pleased to meet you, Master Gromit.
A smart gnome. Well, go on, Chuck. Put him through his little paces. He's voice activated.
Right, that's very... you'd know that was Wallace and Gromit. After a very long gap, is this a sequel?
It is.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a sequel to The Wrong Trousers. But yeah, as I said at the top, it's been 16 years since these lads were on their screens. And I'm glad they're back because it's a fact that whenever Wallace and Gromit are around, the bad things in the world just fade away. Mm. They really do. And for 76 minutes here, they just completely disappeared while I was watching this. And what's on the screen hasn't really changed. You know, Wallace is still this eccentric British inventor who, you know, has this oddball brain but a very kind heart. He still has his loyal anthropomorphic canine companion Gromit, who is still doing absolutely everything for him. That includes, you know, pushing all the buttons in the house so that Wallace gets up and washes himself in the morning. It's behind the scenes that there are a few changes, just a couple. You have Ben Whitehead, who is an actor, a voice actor, and has also voiced Wallace in various different Wallace and Gromit franchise tie-ins, like I think Nick Park was saying before, sat-navs and computer games and all the rest of it. But Peter Salas has obviously died in between the last Wallace and Gromit feature, so Ben Whitehead is taking over. You would not know the difference. It's a respectful, and also it's a lovely tribute to Peter Salas. And then as well as that, you've got technological advancements which allow the guys at Aardman to just spruce up their films ever so slightly with the sort of technology that wouldn't have been available to Nick Park and Peter Lord in 1989 when A Grand Day Out, which was the first Wallace and Gromit film, premiered. But aside from that, it's still all about the clay, and thankfully, because there was a news report a few years ago how they were running out of clay. The factory that they usually go to was shutting down, but they have their clay. They're telling the story, which is a follow-up to The Wrong Trousers, and it's basically Feathers McGraw, the iconic penguin who pretended to be a chicken using a red rubber glove in the fourth film to steal a diamond. He has been sent to prison. I say prison, it's actually a zoo. I should add that, you know, he's accepted what's happened to him, that Wallace and Gromit completely foiled his plan to steal this diamond, and he's going to do his time. You have not lived until you've seen a clay expressionless penguin doing pull-ups in a prison cell. That is just a fabulous scene. Meanwhile, Wallace and Gromit struggling to pay the bills because, you know, Wallace never sells any of his, you know, wacky, wonky inventions. He comes up with this idea to make this smart gnome that will help out around the house. And I don't think he initially thinks that this is going to make money. But once the neighbors see what this gnome can do with, you know, in terms of the gardening, they all want to hire him. So Wallace establishes this company called Gnome Improvements. The Perfect. News are all over us. The news section in this film deserves 5 stars alone. You've got Up North News, where the anchor's name is Anton Deck. fabulous. 5 stars straight away. And then the roving street reporter, her name is Anya Doorstep. So she interviews Wallace. Feathers McGraw sees it from his prison cell. He thinks to himself, and he's just thinking, because these guys have no voices. So the fact that, you know, you can get all of this just from, you know, the silent sequences is brilliant. That's a sign that the storytelling is working. He thinks, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hack into Wallace's mainframe. I'm going to make it so that the gnome turns evil, and that's just going to turn Wallace's world upside down. It's just, I'm in awe of these guys. And I know people might be listening and thinking, well, you know, the Wrong Trousers probably didn't need a sequel, and you're right, but when it's this witty, when it's this clever, when there is a sense that everyone involved is doing it for the right reasons, when the voice work is this good, and also when the animation, because these things take decades to come together. I mean, you would want to have an extraordinary amount of patience to do this thing. When it's as good as this, what, just you might as well keep them coming. It just doesn't make sense to me that 35 years after Wallace and Gromit made their first appearance, that, you know, that they would still be this good. Just does not make sense to me. It's charming, it's thrilling. If every other blockbuster was as thrilling as some of the action sequences that are in this, we're talking about canal boat chases, train explosions, fights with Wellington boots. It's better than anything I saw on the big screen this year. Go see it. It's in cinemas. It's on BBC One on Christmas Day, TG4 on Stephen's Day, and on Netflix in New Year. So you have four options to go see.
Ah, right. Great. Fantastic stuff. Right. Okay. And Mufasa's in cinemas now, is it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Ignore that one.
Okay. Ignore that one. Fionnuala, Christine, thank you all very much. And happy Christmas to you all. And thanks for your contributions through the year.
Movies and Booze. I'm Moncrief.
With Marks and Spencer.
On News Talk.